Palestinians hold a funeral for a 13-year-old boy who was gunned down by Israeli soldiers in the occupied West Bank. Yemeni officials slam Saudi Arabia for refusing to allow three fuel ships to dock at the Hodeidah port despite securing UN clearance. Russia registered more than 41,000 new daily coronavirus infections, the highest number of cases since the beginning of the pandemic. Hello and welcome from our international studios right here in Tehran. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Palestinians have laid to rest the body of a teenager killed by Israeli fire during clashes in the West Bank city of Nablus on Friday. Mohammed Dadis succumbed to his injuries he sustained after he was shot in the abdomen in the village of Beit Dajan. Many others were also injured in the clashes. That after protesters threw rocks at Israeli forces in the area to voice their anger at the regime's settlement construction. But the troops responded with live fire. Palestinian towns have been the scene of protests for months over the regime's settlement activities and planned eviction of families from their ancestral homes. Dozens of people have been killed and many others wounded in the Israeli crackdown on protests this year. Well, Yemen's petroleum company has slammed Saudi Arabia for its refusal to allow three ships carrying fuel to dock at the Hodeidah port. In a statement, the company says the Saudi-led coalition seized the tankers nearly 3 months ago, despite the vessels having secured UN clearance for sailing in international waters. It says the country is in need of fuel to continue its public services. Yemen has been mired in a war and blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia since 2015. Now, the war has killed tens of thousands of people and has destroyed its vital infrastructure. The UN says more than 24 million Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian aid, calling the situation there the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Meanwhile, Yemen's Ansarullah movement has condemned the new U.S. arms deal with Saudi Arabia as a show of Washington's continued support for Riyadh's warmongering. A senior member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council says the deal contradicts U.S. President Joe Biden's stated commitment to peace in Yemen. Abdulatif Awashali reports.
A senior member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mohammed Al-Houthi, has slammed the recent U.S. arms sale to Saudi Arabia, saying it confirms the contradiction in Biden's administration when it comes to Yemen. In a tweet, Al-Houthi said the arms sales once again proved that the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden had no real intention to stop the support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen.
America. The United States is leading the war on Yemen and supports the Saudi-led coalition logistically and militarily. Washington's claims that it would stop the war on Yemen are incorrect, and the evidence for that is the continuation of the U.S. support for terrorist groups across the country. And this was proved through what the Yemeni army found in Al-Qaeda weapons warehouses with USAID logos.
Observers say Biden's promises to stop the war on Yemen have been nothing but lies to gain more votes in the elections. They say the new U.S. missiles sold to Riyadh will be used to bomb Yemenis and fighter jets such as F-15 and not as defensive weapons, contrary to what Washington claims.
The pre-election statements of the U.S. administration were only aimed at winning more votes, and the promises that the support for the Saudi regime and the war on Yemen would be halted were false. The U.S. administration proved that it supports the Saudi regime and that it only seeks to earn more money. The new deal is for offensive weapons, so the new U.S. administration is directly contributing to killing more Yemenis.
Saudi Arabia, with Washington's support, launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015. Over the years, the kingdom has used internationally prohibited weapons, including the U.S. cluster bombs, to target residential areas, according to the Cluster Ammunition Monitor.
Yemenis have long been accusing the U.S. of being the main supporter of the brutal Saudi-led war on their country. People here say they will continue to support Yemen's armed forces, as the armed struggle seems to be the only way to force Riyadh to stop its years-long war and siege. Abdullatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Hashtag trending brings you the internet's reaction to the story of IRGC forces thwarting a U.S. attempt to seize an Iranian fuel shipment in the Sea of Oman.
Hello everyone, welcome to another Hashtag Trending. I'm Sarah Adema, and today we will be viewing the internet's reaction to the story of IRGC forces thwarting a U.S. attempt to seize an Iranian fuel shipment in the Sea of Oman. Stay with me. So, by now, you must have heard the whole story, but just in case, here is everything you need to know in less than 20 seconds. So late in October, Americans confiscated a tanker carrying Iranian oil and transferred its consignment to another vessel. The IRGC then staged a multi-layered maritime operation and managed to navigate the ship towards Iranian waters. It's interesting to note that while the IRGC commandos were carrying out the operation Take Back What Belongs to Us, the two American destroyers sailing close by were forced to back away with their tails between their legs. Alright, now let's get on with your comments. Our first tweet of the day comes from Ayar. He says, "Never approach Iranian tankers again. Is the lesson learned or we continue?" Alright, history tells us that the Americans are slow learners when it comes to the political arena and battlefields, so let's just hope they won't make the same mistakes or else. We have another comment by Adam. He says, "If you are wise, you will never underestimate the power of Iran again. Hashtag lesson learned." Alright, let me give you some background information on these pictures right here. These fellas are American Marines being arrested by the IRGC commandos back in 2016. We have another comment by Negin Razavi. She says, "Real authority vs. false authority. Hashtag lesson learned." That's it for today's edition of the program. I'll see you next time, and until then, stay safe and bye-bye.
Well, Iran has stressed that it will seriously attend the upcoming Vienna talks with the remaining parties to the 2015 nuclear deal. Tehran says it will return to full compliance with the agreement if the U.S. fully implements its obligations and refrains from making demands outside of the scope of the deal. In a phone call with his Russian counterpart, the Iranian foreign minister urged the Europeans and the U.S. to adopt a realistic and constructive stance. Hossein Amir Abdullahian, however, pointed to the recent U.S. sanctions against Iran's drone program, saying Tehran is skeptical about Washington's motives. Also, Sergei Lavrov said all sides should resume implementing the deal, with the U.S. having to do so first. He underlined Russia's stance that the U.S. should cease its destructive approach with regards to the deal. Well, the Vienna talks are set to begin on November the 29th. Meanwhile, Iran is pushing ahead with its coronavirus vaccination campaign. Nearly 885,000 doses have been administered over the past day, raising the overall figure to above 93.5 million. Nearly 55 million Iranians have received their first shots, while over 38 million have had their second. Also, 150,000 people have gotten their booster shots. Iran has seen a decline in its coronavirus death rate amid the mass vaccination campaign. The country has reported its lowest daily deaths since late June with 120 fatalities. New infections also stood at a five-month low of just over 6,800. Health officials, however, have warned against any complacency and demand that the public continue to observe health protocols. Since the beginning of the pandemic, nearly 6 million Iranians have tested positive for the virus. The death toll has topped 127,000. And European countries continue to battle the spread of the coronavirus as the number of infections and deaths soar across the continent. Ukraine reported a record number of COVID-related deaths with 793 fatalities during the past day. Over 25,000 new infections were also reported. Meanwhile, Russian health officials registered over 41,300 new cases. That is the highest number of new infections since the start of the pandemic. There were nearly 1,190 COVID-related deaths on Saturday also. Elsewhere in Europe, Germany witnessed another rise in cases, reporting over 34,000 new infections and 142 new related deaths. The World Health Organization says Europe is once again the epicenter of the pandemic as cases and deaths are on the rise. And now it's time for this hour's news review. An anti-establishment demonstration has turned violent in the British capital, with police clashing with protesters in central London. At least 8 officers were injured during scuffles at Parliament Square. The Metropolitan Police said 12 people were arrested, and demonstrators wearing masks had gathered at the nearby Trafalgar Square, with some throwing Molotov cocktails at the officers. They also burnt an effigy of Prime Minister Boris Johnson in a show of anger towards his policies. November the 5th marks an annual Million Mask March, which draws massive rallies against government overreach, income inequality, and more recently, COVID-19 restrictions. I'd like to welcome my guests to this news review. Ian Williams, senior analyst at a foreign policy and focus out of New York, and John White, writer and political analyst out of Edinburgh. Thank you both for being with me. Well, let me start this off with Ian. Do you think that these demonstration that was held yesterday has taken on a different form than previous years, or is it just a continuous situation that we have seen, especially Anonymous, basically have these demonstrations several years now in a row? Your assessment of yesterday's protests?
Well, I think you have to put it in context that November the 5th has been a 400-year-old British tradition in which Guy Fawkes, a Catholic conspirator who tried to blow up the King of England and Scotland and the House of Commons, is burnt in effigy. So it's always been associated with fireworks and fairly lawless and anarchic behaviour, not necessarily supporting anarchism. I mean, there's one part of the southwest of England where they burn effigies of the Pope. So it's got a general significance. You know, when I was a kid, we used to throw fireworks and the police used to try and stop us, and we'd light bonfires and the police would try to stop us. So it's a celebration of insurrection in general rather than particular causes. And when I was reading the British press, I noticed that one demonstrator interviewed mentioned COVID, and this was suddenly became an anti-vax protest. There's a lot of people very frustrated with Britain. They're very frustrated with the government. They're very frustrated with the authorities. And November the 5th is a sort of festival where people can take their frustrations out. So I wouldn't read too much significance into it. But the graphic novel V for Vendetta, they're all wearing the masks of Guy Fawkes, the guy who was hung, drawn, and quartered for trying to blow up the King and Parliament. So, you know, there's a mixed tradition here. I should say that, I forget who it was, but somebody once said that Guy Fawkes was the only man who ever went into Parliament with honourable intention. He went in with a couple of 100 barrels of gunpowder to blow it up, but he was not progressive in any sense. So, yes, it's a celebration of anarchy and misrule and the police and legitimate targets, and there are lots of targets about. Burning Boris Johnson is a noble and long-standing British tradition, and you know, some people might think it was only an effigy. What a shame.
John, if I have you, your take, I mean, these were basically labeled as anti-capitalist demonstrations, and definitely the British people have been going through a lot, especially in the last couple of years. Your overall assessment of these demonstrations, I mean, Ian said, don't read too much in them. Your take overall?
I think there's a growing sense of disquiet and anger and rage at the way the system is playing out. Huge corruption at the heart of our political system just in the last few days with this parliamentary intrigue whereby Boris Johnson and his clique attempted to overturn the parliamentary standard body because it's about to found one of his closest allies guilty of lobbying, keeping money for companies for future. There's a growing disquiet over the rampant inequality. There's huge, huge disquiet over the climate crisis. COP26 in Glasgow, which is a greenwashing exercise on world leaders coming over in their private jets with their large entourages. It's not that they really believe that they are serious about tackling the ultimate climate emergency. So there's a growing level of disquiet, anger, and rage. Economic crisis, the fallout from COVID, all these things are feeling the same mix of anger. The only problem is this anger is not being channeled in any kind of concerted or organized fashion as yet. It's all disparate movements, whether it's Be for Mandela, whether it's the climate extinction rebellion, whether it's protesting against immigration, whatever it is, there's a lot of seething anger. It's not being channeled in a way that could maybe make it manifest in meaningful change. So there's going to be a bumpy ride ahead. We can only dine out on the myths around the Second World War for so long. We can only dine out for the claims to British exceptionalism, Union Jack for so long. People are suffering. 4 million people are children in poverty. There's going to be a huge crisis of COVID this winter because of the reaction of the restrictions, which might be come too quickly. So who knows what's going to happen? But there is a growing tendency for the societal breakdown to take.
All right. Well, thank you both. Ian Williams, Senior Analyst, Foreign Policy in Focus, out of New York, and John White, writer and political analyst, out of Edinburgh, for being with us on this news review. And thank you for staying with us on this news review. Let's continue with the rest of our news right after this. Now turning to Germany, where a knife attack on an express train has left several people injured. None of the injuries are life-threatening. German police say the alleged perpetrator has been arrested. However, the motive for the attack is still unclear. Local newspapers say the suspect is a 27-year-old man of Arab origin who may be suffering from psychiatric problems. While the attack happened in the early hours today on a train traveling between two southern cities in Germany. Some 100 people have died in a fuel tanker explosion in Sierra Leone's capital, Freetown. Authorities in the West African country say the incident occurred in a densely populated suburb late on Friday. Tens of people have also been injured and transferred to the hospital. Several are in critical condition. Well, that's according to the country's National Disaster Management Agency. Freetown's mayor has cited that a collision with another truck at a busy junction as a cause of the incident. This is the second major fire incident in the capital, Freetown, this year. In March, over 1,000 people lost their lives in a fire that engulfed the city's slums. And with that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Stay tuned, please.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat Obad 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
On the 25th of October, Sudan's General Abdel Fattah el-Burhan imposed a nationwide state of emergency across the country and dissolved Abdullah Hamdok's transitional government and the top ruling body, the Sovereign Council, a joint military-civilian power-sharing authority.
First of all, we are declaring a state of emergency. Second, we are dissolving the Sovereign Council and removing the state governors. We remain committed to the international agreements signed during the rule of the interim government.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Now, this week's edition is focusing on the ongoing political crisis in Sudan after the country's military seized power after dissolving a fragile transitional government. Sudan's people have taken to the streets to condemn the coup. In our show today, we are asking, what is the real reason behind the coup, and are foreign powers such as the U.S. and the Israeli regime involved in fomenting Sudan's political turmoil? Stay with us until the end of the show for the answers.
Sudan in political turmoil. On the 25th of October, the Sudanese military, led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, took control of the transitional government in a military coup. Al-Burhan dissolved the military civilian sovereign council that had been established to guide the country to democracy after the overthrow of long-ruling autocrat Omar al-Bashir in a popular uprising 2 years ago. In essence, he staged a palace coup against the government of Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok and the transitional authority he chaired. Some observers believe that the dispute between the civilian and military leaders in Sudan was exploited to divert the main demands of the Sudanese people.
Following the military takeover, Sudan's main opposition coalition called for civil disobedience and protests across the country. Clashes have rocked Khartoum as Sudan's security forces continue with a crackdown on furious anti-coup protesters. Now, to discuss the unfolding situation in Sudan, my colleague contacted Dr. Nisreen El-Amin, a researcher on foreign land grabs and the militarization of borders in East Africa and the Sahel. We also have Adil Abdelati, a Sudanese politician, media activist, and the chairman of the Sudan of the Future Political Bloc. Now, Dr. El Amin started by elaborating on what she believes is the real reason behind the military takeover in Sudan.
To answer your question, I would say that there are two reasons that behind this military takeover. One is that Al-Burhan, who is the de facto head of state at the moment, was and the head of the Sovereignty Council, which was made up of civilians and military members, was scheduled to hand over power over, you know, it was essentially scheduled to hand over power to the to a civilian member of the Sovereignty Council. And he was unwilling to give up that power, in part because of a fear of being indicted for war crimes that he's responsible for in Darfur, but also during the civil war in South Sudan. The other reason is that there have been conversations within the transitional government that have also led to some of these tensions that I mentioned earlier, because much of the economy is still under the control of military members of the former regime, including Al-Burhan. So currently 250 companies in the areas of gold mining, for example, flour, sesame, and other kind of industries, if you will, are under the control of members of the military. And Hamdok was very much pushing for those companies to be transferred to the government. And so he, you know, Al-Burhan and his deputy Hemeti stood to stand to lose from that kind of transfer.
The actions taken by Sudan's military have many parallels with Egypt's tumultuous summer of 2013. Prime Minister Hamdok and his cabinet ostensibly had responsibility for the day-to-day management of the government. However, their efforts were often been handcuffed by the structure of the transitional government, which favored the military.
Now, our question is, did the civilian leadership place too much trust in the military without learning from other countries, especially neighboring Egypt?
They have succeeded to eliminate all political forces which demanded the giving power to the civilians and a short transitional period. And after 2 months of negotiation, at the beginning, they planned the massacre of the protesters in the sit-in in Khartoum, where hundreds of people were killed at dawn. So that was a way to force other political parties to accept their role in the transitional government. And unfortunately, some of the political parties, they agreed to this and they became partners to them. They succeeded also to arrange the transitional government to be for 3 years, and after that they prolonged this to 4 years.
Well, the coup came hours after U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, held talks with Sudanese military leaders, and this has raised speculation that Washington was aware or actually supported the military takeover. Of course, the U.S. has publicly condemned the coup in Sudan, but this is seen as just a public relations gimmick. Dr. Nesrin gives her take here on the possible role by the United States in the power grab by Sudan's military.
In October, for example, of 2020, Sudan was removed from the state sponsors list, state list of state sponsors of terrorism. And that removal was tied to Sudan being asked to normalize relations with Israel. And that was kind of under the auspices of the United States to position Sudan as kind of to open it up for foreign investment and to allow Sudan to kind of get in the good graces of the international financial institutions and to be able to take out loans and to have its debt, most of its debt really forgiven. And so that's kind of where the U.S. has been a relatively new player, if you will, because Sudan has been isolated for so long, having been on that list. And so, you know, Feldman met with Al-Burhan a few hours before this coup happened or began. And says that he's surprised that it happened. At the same time, you know, Al-Burhan had just visited Sisi in Egypt, and it appears that he kind of got the green light to do what he's done. And so what appears to me is that you have U.S. allies in the region, like Egypt, like Saudi Arabia and the UAE.
Civilian leaders in Sudan had expressed reservations about the country's normalization with the Israeli regime. For instance, Foreign Minister of the ousted Sudanese Transitional Authority, Maryam al-Sadiq al-Mahdi, downplayed normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. Protesters across Sudan also held demonstrations rejecting the move by the Transitional Authority to normalize ties with the Israeli regime, insisting that they will always stand with Palestine.
Most Sudanese oppose the normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. Well, Mr. Adil believes that the recent coup was most likely instigated by the Israeli regime to pave way for complete normalization.
Israeli factor is very important in this coup. We don't know about direct involvement of Israel in organizing the coup, but they could inspire it, or they could promise the military leaders some kind of support. We know that there were a visit from Mossad to Sudan and secret meetings with Al-Burhan and with Hemeti in Sudan and in other countries. We know that there were some kind of intelligence support from Israel to the junta in Sudan. We know that the military leaders, Al-Burhan himself and also Hemeti, were very eager to normalize the situation with Israel and to build diplomatic relations.
While announcing the military takeover, Al-Burhan said the military will appoint a technocrat government to lead the country to elections set for July 2023. But he made clear the military will remain in charge in what is seen as following the same script that was used when the military grabbed power in neighboring Egypt.
We're stressing here that the armed forces intend to complete the democratic transition until the country's leadership is handed over to an elected civilian government who can bring these issues to life.
What is the game plan of the military rulers? Can we expect Sudan to move to a military rule similar to the one in Egypt?
People on the streets have a very clear message that they will not be governed by any government that is formed by Al-Burhan and the military remnants of the al-Bashir regime. And I don't think they're going to be leaving the streets until their demands are met. And so, to me, the comparisons with Egypt are not ones I would like to make. I'm hopeful and very proud of the people who are risking their lives on the street, who are defending this revolution. And I do think that Al-Burhan and his sort of, you know, and his crew, if you will, that their days are numbered.
Several people have been killed after security forces clashed with protesters furious over the military coup. Well, we shall now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall talk about how the United Nations and the African Union reacted to the coup in Sudan. So stay with us.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio. Sudan in political turmoil.
The military coup in Sudan has attracted widespread condemnation internationally. The United Nations has led calls for restoration of civilian rule in the country.
The Secretary General strongly condemns the ongoing military coup d'etat in Khartoum and all actions that could jeopardize Sudan's political transition and stability. The Secretary General calls for the immediate reconstitution of the governing arrangements provided under the constitutional document. Sudanese stakeholders must immediately return to dialogue and engage in good faith to restore the constitutional order and Sudan's transitional process. The United Nations reiterates its unwavering commitment and support to the realization of Sudan's political transition. Any attempt to undermine the transition process puts at risk Sudan's security, stability, and development.
The African Union has said it suspended Sudan from all its activities after the country's military overthrew the civilian-led transitional government. The continent-wide bloc said it strongly condemns the seizure of power and was suspending Sudan from all AU activities until the effective restoration of the civilian-led transitional authority. This move by the African Union was similar to other measures in the wake of military coups in the continent.
Mr. Adil believes that failure by the African Union to take tangible action against coup leaders will affect the credibility of this pan-African organization.
The African Union failed the African people in preventing military leaders from gaining power and in dealing with coups like in Mali, like in Guinea, and in other countries now in Sudan. And the position of the African Union is very, very weak. That is because the African Union almost consisted of different countries which are ruled by military leaders. And it is an organization of official countries and official government. So this is that is the reason why their positions are very weak. The Sudanese people are not looking anymore for the African Union to defend them. Rather, they are relying on themselves and on some limited international support.
The transitional authority led by General Burhan had pledged to cooperate with the International Criminal Court, which has issued arrest warrants for Bashir for alleged war crimes in the restive Darfur region. However, the pursuit of justice over Darfur was a point of tension between the military and civilian leaders.
The military has always appeared reluctant in taking action on the thorny issue of handing Bashir over to the ICC to be charged with crimes against humanity. The question many are asking is, will this file be closed after the coup?
I think in many ways, as I said earlier, Al-Burhan has been resistant to hand over power to a civilian member of the Sovereignty Council, in part because he fears being indicted for similar war crimes, right, that al-Bashir has been indicted for by the ICC. And so, you know, in some ways, I think it might be, we might have to sort of think about that file is closed, but it's also unclear. I mean, they've thrown al-Bashir under the bus before, so.
In late 2019, a Sudanese court convicted former President Omar al-Bashir on corruption charges and sentenced him to 2 years of detention in a reform facility. Many analysts, including Adil, believe the sentence was lenient due to the influence of Bashir within the military.
Bashir is a mentor of these generals. He was their commander of chief for 30 years, and they are very connected to him. Also, they are afraid that Bashir will become a witness against them if he's handed to the international criminal law, and he will bring them by witnessing also against them as partners in the crimes. So they will never give him, and they will never give him even a good trial in Sudan for his crimes against humanity, for genocide, and for war crimes.
General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and other Sudanese military leaders have close ties to Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. It's clearly not in the interest of these countries to see a democratic Sudan.
The The U.S. is trying to distort and misdirect the popular revolutionary movement in Sudan to prevent similar movements from gaining popularity in Arab regimes allied to Washington. So what role, if any, did regional powers such as Egypt, the UAE, and Saudi Arabia play in the current military takeover in Sudan?
I mean, they're probably the more major players. And I think one of the things to remember is that Al-Burhan, he was trained in a military college in Egypt, has strong ties to Sisi, and was always seen as, he also actually played an important role in supporting the Saudi coalition to fight in the war in Yemen. And so I think at that time we saw Al-Burhan and others emerge as kind of more loyal allies to the Saudi, UAE, Egypt kind of coalition. And they actually pledged, as soon as al-Bashir was ousted, the Saudi Arabia and the UAE immediately pledged about $2 billion in aid to support the Transitional Military Council before the partnership and the transitional government was formed. So right there you see that they've always been very supportive of the military elements of this government.
Well, unfortunately, our time is up for today. I would like to thank our guest, Dr. Nisreen El-Amin, a researcher on foreign land grabs and militarization of borders in East Africa and the Sahel, and also Adil Abdelati, a Sudanese politician and chairman of the Sudan of the Future political bloc. Here at Africa Today, we shall continue giving you an alternative view of events taking place in Africa. And that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your views. From me, Mubarak Kenya, it's goodbye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
Current commitments to cut greenhouse gas emissions put the planet on track for a catastrophic average 2.7 degrees Celsius temperature rise this century, the United Nations has said, the latest stark warning ahead of crunch climate talks. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by the staff of Al Jazeera English website. This article is published under the heading Climate Catastrophe, World Faces 2.7 degrees Celsius Temperature Rise. Stay tuned for the details, please. Current commitments to cut greenhouse gas emissions put the planet on track for a catastrophic average 2.7 degrees Celsius temperature rise this century, the United Nations has said, the latest stark warning ahead of crunch climate talks. Just days before the COP26 climate summit in the Scottish city of Glasgow, the UN's environment program, UNEP, said recently national plans to reduce carbon pollution amounted to weak promises not yet delivered. The G20 countries are responsible for 78% of all emissions, so to do it item lies with them. Ignar Andersson, executive director of the UNEP, told Al Jazeera, adding that developed countries have a special responsibility to really step up, but actually everyone does, all 193 member states. Andersson said much of the pledged action by countries is delayed until 2030, which scientists warn will be far too late to halt the worst ravages of climate change on the planet. Action is needed now, she warned. Governments will be in the spotlight at COP26 conference next week to meet the deadline of this year to commit to more ambitious greenhouse gas cut promises in what could be the last chance to put the world on track to limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. This would help prevent the worst imagined catastrophic changes threatening the planet, scientists say. As extreme weather events including superstorms, forest fires, and floods increasingly hit countries around the world, even the slightest increase in global temperatures will worsen the situation. The UN World Meteorological Organization said ahead of the two-week event, which will begin soon, that greenhouse gas concentrations hit a record last year and the world is way off track in capping rising temperatures. If all pledges by 192 countries under the Paris Agreement are taken together, an increase of about 16% in global emissions is expected by 2030 compared with 2010, which would lead to warming of 2.7 degrees Celsius by the end of the century, a figure where life on Earth would be devastating for millions of people. UN Chief Antonio Guterres said recently of the report that this report showed the world was still on track for climate catastrophe. This report is another thundering wake-up call. How many do we need? The emissions gap is the result of a leadership gap, Guterres told a press briefing, adding, the era of half measures and hollow promises must end. The time for closing the leadership gap must begin in Glasgow. UNEP said most recent commitments would shave 7.5% off previously predicted 2030 emissions levels. To keep on a 1.5 Celsius trajectory, a 55% reduction is needed. The report said plans of many of the 49 countries that have made net zero pledges remained vague and were not reflected in their formal commitments. Anderson said, "We have 8 years to make the plans, put in place the policies, implement them, and ultimately deliver the cuts. The clock is ticking loudly." The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in August said Earth could hit the 1.5 degrees Celsius threshold as soon as 2030 and be consistently above it by mid-century. The report said even if all net zero pledges were delivered in full, there was a 60% chance that temperature rises would hit 2.7 degrees Celsius by 2100. There is no appetite for reducing fossil fuel consumption globally at the rate required to meet our climate goals, said Miles Allen, professor of geosystem science at the University of Oxford.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. We'll be right back.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.